Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Today's show is brought to you by Show Dog Prep School. Online courses, webinars, and mentor programs on demand at showdogprepschool.com. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I have with me today as very special guest, Sheila Goff, who is the Vice President of Government Relations at the American Kennel Club. And you guys, we've talked to Sheila before, and Sheila has some pretty amazing information to share with us today. So, Sheila, welcome. Tell me about this amazing legislation.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we are just incredibly excited. We've had a really big legislative victory.
Yes.
And we can thank a lot of folks for helping us with this. And it comes down to doing something not only for dog owners, but for national security. A lot of people probably are not aware that currently those amazing exposure detection dogs that you see in the airports, they're primarily black labs, some Vizslas, German wire hair pointers, short hair pointers. 80 to 90% of those dogs are imported from overseas. And not only are they currently being imported from overseas, but there's an enormous shortage of high quality dogs available, both whether it's for private contractors, for public venues, for government, military, TSA. And so in a world where we are seeing more and more terrorism, what we do know is that explosive detection dogs are probably one of the single best ways we can protect ourselves against bombs, bomb threats, explosives, you name it. One of the neat things about explosive detection dogs, if you think of all the incredibly high technology that we have today to deal with security, to deal with military, et cetera, there is no single technology better, more accurate, more effective, more cost-effective, or more transportable than our man's best friend, our dog and our dog's noses. It's gotten to the point, in fact, where with this shortage of dogs, TSA actually came to the American Kennel Club a couple of years ago looking for dogs. Hey, AKC, you're the dog people.
Right.
Can you help us get good dogs?
Right.
So we decided to take this challenge seriously, and we had to do some research, learn about the type of dogs that they're looking for. And this was a project that Dr. Carmen Battaglia has been very, very involved in, really heading up what we called our Detection Dog Task Force. And as a result of it, we learned a number of interesting things. We learned about the fact that there truly is a shortage of detection dogs worldwide. Since 9/11, with increasing terrorist activity, the demand for dogs has skyrocketed. And every time, you know, we see another horrible event on the news, whether it's you know, Manchester, England, or Chelsea, New York, or, you know, Brussels, The demand for these dogs is going up. Worldwide, just about everybody goes to Europe to get explosive detection dogs. So what makes an explosive detection dog? What we're looking for are dogs traditionally out of the mold of our best sporting dogs.
Right.
So there's typically retrievers, they may be pointers, other types of sporting dogs. They have the drive to work all day. They're toy motivated, and you see this a lot with the dogs in the airport, police dogs, patrol dogs. They're always working for that call.
Right.
They're dogs that you can take into an airport, and they aren't really going to scare people too much. So that's why currently we're looking at more at labs and sporting dogs rather than, you know, the pointy-eared dogs, the
right.
Like the Malinois and the Shepherds, et cetera. And, of course, highly trainable. So the most popular type of explosive detection dog right now is, go figure, the Labrador Retriever.
Right.
So here's the irony. We have an amazing number of phenomenal Labrador Retriever breeders in this country, particularly those who are really training, you know, really breeding and training for being sporting dogs.
Right.
We have Labrador Retrievers being the single most popular breed in the United States, single most registered breed in the United States, and we have the U.S. government going overseas to buy Lab Retrievers.
Right.
Something wrong with this picture. So that was the picture that was handed to us, and we decided, okay, we need to really try to get at the issues. What we learned, and this is something that I testified last year before Congress on, is that, first of all, there's a strong tradition of just simply going to Europe to get working dogs.
Right.
And secondly, we've seen historically over the last generation so much legislation, so much anti-breeder feeling, we don't have the kind of breeders that we need to be breeding these dogs, not to the extent that they still have in Europe. We don't have that tradition of the kennel, of Schutzhund, and those dogs that are being trained, you know, specifically for really police explosives, patrol type dogs.
Right. Well, and a lot of, I mean, think about it, Sheila, the 90% of the breeders in this country legitimately are breeding for a pet market. And the dog that's going to go out and do the work that the detection dogs need to do is a dog that is going to be more dog than your average suburban home with two kids is going to want to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And it's something that when we work with breeders on this, we really do point out that, for example, the labs, you have more the sporting type dog, you have the pet type dog, you have the show type dog. And what we're really focusing in, we find what makes the best working dogs for explosive detection are the ones that are field trained.
Yep.
You know, they can't think of a better day than going out there and retrieving birds all day. That is, you know, what they live for. And those are really the dogs that make it in these programs.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're finding too, and we started questioning, well, how many dogs are we actually importing from overseas? And what are we paying for these dogs? And why are we going to Europe? Have we really looked at what's available here in the United States?
Right.
And what we found was that there was absolutely no transparency in how the government was obtaining dogs, or when working with U.S. vendors, what exactly their standards were.
Yes.
You know, what
that's
they were
huge.
Looking for.
Right.
It's incredibly huge because the thing is, it's understandable if you take a dog to be tested for being an explosive detection dog until you flunk out. You know, it's got great hips, you know, it's got great knees, you know, it's got great drive. Why didn't it make it? It's okay. We get it. You know, being show dog people, we understand dog isn't going to have a great day every day. But let me find out what I need to do for my breeding program to make the dog better suited to what you need.
Right.
And we had a lot of vendors saying, we're not getting that feedback. So we're doing what we think they want, but there's no real standards. And for the standards they have, then we're finding that evaluators at Lackland Air Force Base, when they go and look at these dogs, are just saying, nope, not this one. But they're not getting a response as to why it failed.
Right.
Yeah. Why it failed. Or what they can do to make it better. So we actually got involved in a couple of bills to try to change that. The first thing we wanted to do was we wanted to make Department of Defense, TSA, and the government agencies buying dogs just be responsible for providing information as to what they were paying for the dogs, what their standards were, how those dogs were doing when they came back to the United States, and what is the real cost of buying a dog over in Europe, sending people over to Europe to test these dogs,
mm-hmm.
then bringing them back, then putting them into a training program,
mm-hmm.
and then how many of them succeed versus American bred dogs? And what we found was there's absolutely no information available and no information on the actual cost of when you add up all the costs of going to Europe versus getting a U.S. bred dog.
Right.
What does it actually cost to have a dog that's fully trained and ready to deploy? So we added language to the National Defense Authorization Act in 2017 to require that DOD provide a report on basically the comparative expenses between obtaining dogs here in the United States and overseas, how many were actually succeeding in the programs, what happened to the dogs. And this is another important point, too. There's been a lot of discussion about this.
Yes.
We're interested also in ensuring that after that dog has a great working career, what happens to it?
Yes, that's a huge question, Sheila.
It's a big, big question. And you know, to be honest, there's a huge demand for those dogs when they retire.
Mm-hmm.
But we just want to make sure that the people who want to adopt them can get them. And at the same time, we don't want them to fall into the wrong hands.
Right.
So we wanted some reporting on that. So we were very pleased. We were successful. That language passed into law as part of the Defense Authorization Act last year. And then we decided that was a great step one, but now we also need to really take that information that we learned from the government reports and turn it into something that's actually useful for our brooders so that we can, as AKC, facilitate that relationship between the government and our breeders who might be interested in breeding working dogs
right.
for military and understanding what do you need to do to breed one of these dogs. We've got these amazing, amazing breeders. We have so much knowledge and expertise on the genetics and on the pedigree, and we're looking at the genomics of these dogs. We're looking at advanced, you know, the health statistics. The health tests are tremendous for these dogs. So these are really, you know, to quote Dr. Battaglia, these are really super dogs.
Right.
But that's what so many of us care about breeding.
Right. And it was fascinating to me at the Detection Dog Conference that I attended, saw you there. I was shocked. I mean, shocked when I heard that these dogs that are coming from Europe, we have no pedigree information on them. We have no health testing information on them. Really? Wow.
No, and here's the issue. Even if these are phenomenal working dogs,
right.
do we want to breed them? And right. are they going to breed true?
Right.
In many cases, we really don't even know. I mean, well, they look like something.
Right.
Do we even know that they are what we think they are?
Right.
So we don't even know, you know, what the pedigree, what's behind these dogs. And so really working to develop a U.S. breeding program. And by that, we're looking at decentralized. It's not a case that AKC is going to be breeding dogs. It's not a case that we want the government to be breeding dogs.
Right.
They've tried that a few times, and it's failed. But what we want to do is bring together all the best expertise and have sort of a center of excellence that's available to anybody who wants to provide these dogs really as a national service. And the amazing thing about it, too, though, is, I mean, you are selling these dogs. It's not like you're giving away your best dog.
Exactly.
So it's not like, okay, this dog is the best dog I've ever produced, and I'm going to give them to the government. No, it's we are producing excellent dogs that can do a job, and we can be assured that they are well cared for, they're taken care of, and at the end of their working career, they're going to be going to a good home. Usually we find their handlers want to adopt them, and
right.
who can blame them, right?
Right.
You've been working
right.
with a dog for years. Of course you're going to want to bring that dog home and give it a great retirement.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. All right, crew. Last month, I was filling you in on the Trupanion Breeder Support Program. And in case you missed it, this is a free program for breeders that lets us offer our buyers, our puppy buyers, a go-home day offer so that they can try out Trupanion and everybody has the peace of mind that that puppy is covered in case of any kind of an incident. But I was talking to Haran recently, and I didn't realize at the time that they actually have a breeding rider that is additional to the regular healthcare coverage that Trupanion offers our dogs. And so I wanted to bring Haran Greer from Trupanion back to tell us about it because I was blown away. So welcome, Haran.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me back. And I'm happy this came up in conversation.
Yeah, right? So tell us about it. This is pretty incredible to me.
Yeah, so I'll just start at the basics, you know. So if you join Trupanion, we just have one simple plan. It's 90% coverage for the unexpected illnesses, accidents, and injuries. And then from there, breeders can add a breeding rider coverage to make sure that they're protected from the unexpected things that can happen with breeding.
Okay, so what does that cover? What kind of things are you covering in your claims with the breeding rider?
So it's truly things that are unexpected. So anything that you can't plan for in advance is what Trupanion gives you peace of mind from, right? But with the breeding rider, you know, the most common claim that we see are for C-section.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was looking through, I was curious just to see what kind of claims we have been seeing in the past year. I was surprised that pyometra payouts have exceeded what we've paid out for C-section.
Wow.
So the claims paid ranged from the lowest one that we paid out was $1,740. And the highest one to date this year has been $5,500.
That's pretty incredible. So how much does a person pay to add that breeding rider to their regular insurance coverage?
So that rider has variables. You'll want to give us a call or go to our website. The factors are things like where you live, what breed you have, is it a male or female, how old are they, and then the deductible. And those deductible options is where, you know, the flexibility comes in for your monthly payment. And those range from $0 to $1,000.
Okay, beautiful. So check it out, listeners, puredogtalk.com. You can find the Trupanion website. Just click that logo and it will take you in to get lots and lots of information about some stuff that I think not all of us always think about. So thank you, Haran. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Laura. I hope to be back on soon.
And so, Sheila, one of the other things that, and I want to get to this legislation that you guys just passed, but I thought I really did want to kind of dial in on this particular thing because we haven't really had a chance to talk about it on the show. And that is at the Detection Dog Conference, one of the primary things that was being discussed is how to make that plan for the breeder that has produced a litter of puppies that they think has potential to do this and they need to be raised up to 10 to 12 months old. What are the processes? What's my ABCD, you know, in terms of what do I need to do with this dog? And some of the programs being developed to address that, I think, are fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's one of the biggest challenges we have right now, too.
Yeah.
Because it's easy enough to sell a dog at 10 weeks.
Right.
What we're looking at is typically these dogs don't go into serious training as explosive detection dogs in government programs until they're, say, 10 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do with that whole crucial sort of growth period for these dogs? And so modest levels of training and environment and developing the stability is so important there. And so what we've been doing is really going out and talking to the experts and trying to figure out, you know, what is the best thinking on how you raise these dogs to be super stable, able to handle situations that can be difficult. You can have, you'll be getting on and off planes. You might be traveling around the world. You could be deployed in the Middle East. These are dogs that, you know, they're looking for mines.
Yeah.
And they're working like our field dogs, you know, 100 yards away, 100 feet away.
Sound minds and work ethic. I mean, what I took away from that was sound minds and work ethic.
And great work ethic.
Yep.
So what do you do with these little guys when they're, you know, 12 weeks old, 14 weeks old? So we've been working with the Penn Vet, University of Pennsylvania Vet School, working dog program. We've been working with Auburn University. We've been working with a lot of really phenomenal canine researchers, behavioralists, trainers, et cetera, trying to bring together a pilot program for training these dogs.
Yeah.
And one of the next steps that we want to be able to do is to do this pilot program, provide videos, educational blogs, following what you do kind of on, you know, week-to-week basis for raising one of these dogs so that when it's 10 months old, it is absolutely ready to go.
Right.
So that's one of the things that's next up for us. But right now we've been getting just an amazing amount of research and intelligence on how to go about that. Next step is to really put it together for our breeders.
Excellent. So now last year's legislation was, okay, tell us how much you're spending. Did you actually get information from the military yet on that or no? From the government?
It's funny. We were just having this conversation before I got on the phone with you because it's been a little frustrating.
Right.
Government time, I think, is a little different from
island time, government time.
Yeah, right. So first, it's supposed to be an annual report for the next, you know, several years. And it's supposed to have been out in the summer, essentially. And I'm being generous by saying we're supposed to have it in the summer, to be honest. And we haven't seen it yet. But specifically, you know, in that report was, again, it was, tell us how many military working dogs you need. What do we need? We don't know what we need. You tell us that.
Right.
And make sure that the performance standards are available to breeders and trainers so that they know what to do. And let's please coordinate with the state and local agencies and the universities to increase the training capacity. Let them know. Let us know what we can do to improve the capacity. And then also, we require DOD to encourage the efficiency and cost-effective domestic breeding programs, either through grants or through other assistance, so that the programs out there could be assisted, you know, through government funds as well. And now we're waiting for the report back.
Perfect. Okay, so so where does that leave us then with this current piece of legislation that was just now passed through both houses of Congress? Am I correct?
That is correct. Yes. So it started off as House Bill 4577, and that's what a lot of people know about it. It is called the Domestic Explosives Dog Capacity Building Act, and it passed very quickly through the House, thanks to a phenomenal sponsor, Congressman Mike Rogers of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
He has been a hero. He has been an advocate for working dogs, detection dogs, for years. He is a natural person to work with on this. Got through the House, and then it stalled in the Senate. So at the time of our conference, we decided to take a slightly different tack. And instead of pushing it through Senate Commerce, we said, okay, the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill that every 5 years is coming up. Mm-hmm. It's a must-pass piece of legislation. You know, you need air traffic controllers.
Right.
I don't want to get on a plane unless the government's paying air traffic controllers. So this is the bill that does that. So we added the language. I should say we got the language added to the FAA reauthorization bill. And then that passed both houses of Congress, and there you are. That is how sausage and politics and laws are made.
Well, and I think the most important piece of this to me, frankly, is the fact that AKC is actively involved in doing this. And that, I think, is a message that cannot be shouted from the rooftops enough. I know there are plenty of people who say, gee, about time, but realistically, hey, let's praise what we have, right? Let's, you know, let's say good job.
Absolutely.
Attaboy.
we're excited to accomplish this. We've accomplished other things. I mean,
we've accomplished many
things. But, you know, it's funny. It takes time to build a foundation, too.
Yes.
When working with Congress and working with legislators, it's something that we talk a lot about when we do our legislative conferences.
Right.
You have to develop a relationship with these folks so they know that you're credible.
Right.
That you're not going to stab them in the back, that you're there for them.
An honest broker.
You're going to be supportive.
Yeah.
Yes, an honest broker. And so the great thing is that having developed this relationship over the last number of years, we are now able to go ahead and get these things done in Congress. So it's pretty exciting.
Nice.
And I think you had asked, like, so what's actually in this piece of legislation?
Yes.
And so what it does is, it's pretty innocuous sounding, but very exciting. It creates a public-private working group to develop what they call a decentralized domestic canine breeding network. So what's a decentralized domestic canine breeding network? It sounds like a lot of government gobbledygook. What it means is they are providing support to centers of excellence, such as I laid out earlier, and to assist breeders in building the best dog for the job. In breeding, raising, training, you know, the best dogs for this job.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the best things that I heard said when I was testifying in Congress about this was Congressman John Katko got up and said, Katko is out of New York, he said, well, we just need to breed more dogs. And I said, hallelujah!
That's awesome.
I need to hear that more often in Congress. More high-quality dogs. We need to support our breeders. And what this bill does is it comes out and it supports good breeders. It says, you know, hey, these breeders are important to our national security. These are an important part of our lives. It's not even about having that great pet. It's about breeders being an important part of the fabric of our lives here.
Wow.
So that's sort of big emotional kind of yay, rah, rah takeaway. It's kind of a turning point.
That is a huge turning point, Sheila, because up until...
Suddenly.
You know,
Suddenly, like, oh, wow. You know, we've been sold these terrible lies about breeders.
Right.
Gosh, you know what? These breeders are really good people.
Right.
They do good things, and their dogs are amazing. And it's all about purpose-bred dogs, which is what we have been talking about for years and years and years.
Right.
And the other things this does, too, are really great. This public-private working group, which the American Kennel Club expects to be a part of, along with TSA, several research universities, and other top experts in training and everything from training, contracting, breeding, which is HAC's role in this, et cetera, I should say the educational side of breeding, we are going to be establishing the baseline behavioral, medical, and technical standards for explosive detection dogs. So we now know what the baseline standard is.
Oh, yay!
So, hey, it's a new standard, and it's going to be out there, and it's going to be transparent.
And when do we expect to see this, Sheila, even on island time?
Even on island time, we hope to see it soon. We expect to get moving, you know, and as this sounds crazy, but before the end of the year. Now, that may sound like a long time, but it really isn't. That's pretty fast.
That's super fast.
That's really pretty fast.
On island time, that's like rapid speed.
Oh, yeah. But you know what the great thing is? People realize this is about national security.
Yeah.
This is about our public security.
Right.
This is incredibly important. These dogs are saving lives.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to do it. And people, I think, didn't understand previously when there were efforts before to really raise awareness about the value of these dogs. This is one of the most important tools we have for protecting our public. And we see these dogs, where we're lucky, we see these dogs in our airports. We see them, you know, at the Super Bowl. We see them wherever there's big venues, and we need them there because they are the best tool we have.
Right.
So it's incredibly important.
So say I'm a breeder and I'm breeding, we'll just use me as an example. I'm breeding German wirehair pointers that do all kinds of things that are very much a working mind and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
How do I or John Q listener get to be involved in this? What is the mechanism? What is the process?
So the process is going to be, there are going to be a couple ways to do it. First of all, we already have some people who are vendors who are actually providing dogs, because there's that other 10% here in the United States who are being bred, trained, and provided to the government.
Right.
So we're going to be working with them to gain their expertise. AKC is going to be working with the government as the facilitator to get this information out. And then potentially it's going to be serving as a facilitator between the government and breeders. And what we have not yet figured out, and we do need to figure out, is do breeders want to go to the government individually and say, hey, I have these dogs, I'm interested in the contract, or does it make more sense for there to be essentially like a clearinghouse where we have multiple breeders getting together as a group and saying, we have these dogs that are going to be ready to go. And so that's one of the things that the working group is going to be looking at, because, again, one of the big reasons that it's been so difficult to get U.S. breeders to breed dogs for this purpose is the government contracting process is so rigid. It's so complex. What breeder wants to deal with that if they can just easily sell a great dog to a wonderful home or they go through the government contracting process? So a big part of what we're doing with legislation and regulatory change is to make it a whole lot easier for the government to work with breeders and for breeders to work with the government. So that's an area that we're going to be really focusing down on. And one area I think that's going to be really important for us is actually getting feedback from breeders who are producing these types of dogs currently or capable of producing them and finding out what do they think.
Right.
What's best for them?
Right.
And at the same time, working with the government, saying, okay, let's get everybody together. Let's figure out what's going to actually work and get the breeders engaged and involved in the process where they've really never been able to do it before.
Yes.
So that is the role, too, of some of our ongoing detection dog conferences, is to bring everybody together in a room and have this conversation and kind of figure this out.
Yeah. I enjoyed that conference very much.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's going to be interesting. It's probably one of the next big tasks ahead of us is actually developing, you know, that process with input from everybody so we know what's going to work.
Right. Excellent. All right. Well, Sheila, I appreciate your time tremendously. I appreciate your work on behalf of the sport even more. And thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
All right, listeners, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Excellent. And I am super excited to hear your tip of the week on dryer sheets.
Yes, I always like to surprise you with at least one tip.
This is a great one. I love it. Go.
There you go. So, you know, at this time of year, the dog shows tend to be a little bit more spread out. We're going into a lot more indoor dog shows where the buildings can be dry. The hotel rooms are drier because the heat is on. Our cars are drier because the heat is on. And so it just tends to be like a lot more static in our lives for those coated breeds, mm-hmm. you know, and then you add to the fact that a lot of times they're in like a very kennel or like a solid sided kennel. So every time they get up, sit down, spin around, we're just adding static, right? Like just by their coat touching the sides of things, etc. So something that I've done for a very long time, you know, ever since I was an assistant working for somebody, which is how I learned it, is we have always used dryer sheets in our dogs' kennels, kind of starting about this time of year, like the beginning of October until springtime. So, of course, we don't want the dog to eat the dryer sheet.
Right. That was, of course, my first reaction. I have wire hairs. Come on, man.
Right. You want to be very, very careful. You know, if I have a dog that ruins the inside of their kennel or is just a big chewer, clearly I don't do it. And I don't have the dryer sheet hanging down like a stalactite from the ceiling of the crate. So it's hard to do in the beginning, but you get good at it after a while. So literally I put the dryer sheet flat up on the roof of the kennel and I duct tape it. So it's like solidly taped around all edges. And most dogs don't even notice
right.
the dryer sheet. And that's what we want, right?
Perfect.
You're going to want to change it about once a month, depending on how much you travel. And because I just came back from doing a big seminar in Europe, where this was one of my tips, for people that might be listening that aren't in North America, we put dryer sheets in our dryers to cut down static, and you don't. You use those little felt balls and stuff.
Right.
So for people in Europe, what I have told them to do is to take a very small rag or half of a face cloth and soak it in fabric softener and let it dry and then do the same thing. Tape that into the top of the kennel.
Oh, very
and
nice.
I've had a couple friends over there do that and that's worked for them as well. So for those of you without dryer sheets,
we're sorry.
We're sorry. And there's the alternative for you.
Awesome.
But I had people looking at me like, what's a dryer sheet?
Right.
Yeah, it was kind of funny.
Oh my
gosh.
Anyway,
that's my tip.
I love it. That is a great one. And thank you for always bringing me great delight in every time we have one of these recording sessions.
Anytime.
Awesome. Thank you, Allison. Listeners, don't forget Leading Edge Dog Show Academy, now available by subscription. And when you check out, your code of Pure Dog Talk 25 will give you a 25% discount on your course. Yay.
Yay.
Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Laura.
And now a quick tip from our friends at American Dog Fancier. ADF says, remember to thank the judges for your dog's award. And when you do, please make sure that you spell their names correctly. American Dog Fancier. Affordable show dog advertising. Mention Pure Dog Talk and get 10% off your first ad with American Dog Fancier. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.